Hello, everyone, and welcome to Police Off the Cuff, Real Crime Stories. I'm your host, retired NYPD Sergeant Bill Cannon, a 27-year veteran of the NYPD. We haven't been on the Idaho quadruple case, the Brian Kroberger case, in a while, but some court action has been occurring, and specifically, this is the thumbnail we have. Brian Kroberger's alibi, is there any merit to it? And as you guys that have been following this case have recalled, months ago, his attorney, Ann Taylor, said that they have an alibi. And so the judge was anxiously waiting to hear, well, what is it? You can't say you have an alibi and then not present the alibi. And when you present an alibi, you either must present an alibi witness or the person trying to bring up the alibi maybe has to testify. But we'll go over that with our legal expert tonight. But everyone was waiting for, okay, Kroberger's got an alibi. What is it? We want to hear what it is. And when you hear it, I don't want to prejudice you or lean you one way or the other, but you may be a little bit, I'm going to use a New York slang word, you may be a little bit fugazi about it. You may say, whoa, I don't know about that one. I don't know if I'm buying that. But we'll talk about it. We'll look into it. Glad to see that Kroberger has some defenses. He's got a good defense attorney named Ann Taylor, but now an alibi. So we'll see what that alibi is. So guys, hold on to your seats. Hang on to your hats. You're about to enter true crime from a police perspective, and you're about to enter it off the cuff. You're entering the off-the-cuff zone. There has to be some common sense.
Yes, sir. They have the car stopped at 10th and Grant.
We still don't know who pulled the trigger. We are back and we're ready. I taught all you guys a new word. Fugazi means it's a little shaky, you know. It's all over the place. That's a New York slang word. We have two guests tonight, and you're going to be thrilled when you see who they are. And of course, I know everyone loves Professor Mike Geary, Father Mike Geary, you know, Sergeant Mike Geary. So I'm going to bring him right on the show. My co-host this evening from Professor Albertus from Albertus Magnus College in Connecticut, retired NYPD sergeant, law degree, our legal expert, Mike Geary. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Billy, good evening. Good to see you. Thank you for having me on. Welcome, everyone.
You know, Mike acts like, you know, I invite him on. He loves coming on. And I'm just kidding. He loves to come on, and I love having him on. So I'm glad he's available. I'm glad he has no life, so he's available most times that I call him. We also have another excellent guest. And again, you guys love her. I gave it away. And she's also a professor, doctor. She's a doctor of criminology, and she teaches at St. Thomas University in that horrible tropical place called Miami. She even has some sun on her nose today. So welcome to the show, Dr. Debbie Goodman. Welcome, Dr. Debbie.
Thank you so much, Sergeant Bill. Professor Mike, all the great viewers, always an honor and privilege to join you. Thanks for having me.
I think the women that watch this show and most of our audience is women, believe it or not. I don't want to tell them the percentage because they'll give me a hard time, but they love you, Dr. Debbie. They absolutely do. So I'm thrilled that you're on the show. So let's talk about this a little bit. And I'm going to first address this to Professor Mike because we have the legal aspects of this. Now, Mike, I don't have this. I can't enlarge this. This is the paperwork. Right. Notice of defendant's supplemental response to state's alibi demand. Because if an attorney brings up an alibi in the court proceedings, you better come up with the damn thing, right, Mike?
Yeah, usually Right after arraignment, I know it's like this way in New York, it's 20 days after arraignment. And I'm going to guess it's probably 20 to 30 days also after his arraignment early last spring, almost a year ago now, at least a year ago. He was required by law, by Idaho rules of criminal procedure and rules of the court, to, if he had an alibi, he had to notify the court and he had to notify the district attorney in writing of the alibi witness, their name, their address, their phone number, that sort of thing. So this way there will be no last minute surprises sprung on the prosecution. Ann Taylor came up with an alibi that really was lacking in any sort of presence whatsoever. No name of anyone, no identification, just that he was out. And the district attorney did not accept that. And the judge ruled that it wasn't acceptable under Idaho state law. They had to come up with a name. And he gave them a date, deadline of like last week. And at the very last second, no time to spare, Ann Taylor came up with her new alibi, which is what we're going to talk about at the very last second. And we can discuss whether or not we think it holds any water.
You know, Mike, frequently in homicide investigations, when you are going through potential suspects and you want to eliminate people because you want to include people as well as eliminate. And one of the ways is they have an alibi. Well, what's your alibi? I was at work. Okay. You go check. He was at work. He couldn't have committed a dirty deed. So very simple. That's the most simple type of alibi. But this one is really fugazi because he's claiming to be driving around, stargazing, jogging, hiking, bird watching, all in between 2 and 4 or 2 and 6 in the morning when it's about 2 degrees out. It just passed the smell test. Dr. Debbie, I'm dying to hear what you have to say about this.
Okay, I do have something to say, and let's just start with something that's valid and something that's not. If we really want to look at it, and you know the case so well, Sergeant Bill, and you, Professor Mike, the ins and outs of this case. So if we're looking at real solid, tangible evidence, we're looking at what the prosecution is bringing to the table, the DNA of the knife sheath, the surveillance, the footage of the white Elantra, the at least one dozen phone pings preceding the brutal attack at King Road, the home there. We're also going to verify during trial that he had communication one way to two of the victims. They did not reply, but he wrote to them on social media. And we will also see that he's had photographs on his phone of two of the victims. So we're really coming in with that type of solid information. Now, in terms of this alibi, remember, we did hear about it and we spoke about it, Sergeant Bill, possibly even as early as January. And I referred to it as this long drive to nowhere, where this alibi has so many holes like a Swiss cheese argument. And if we really think about what has been said here, this, as you've just said, Sergeant Bill, the long drive and the hiking and the stargazing and the moon, so perfect. It almost feels like to me a kindergarten student saying what he did one night. Oh, I went for a drive. And the teacher saying, well, can you be more specific? Yes, I was gazing at the moon and the stars.
Right.
Just nonsense. And yet we'll address the issue, of course, during the show. But we know there will be an expert who will say that it couldn't possibly be Brian Koberger because he was nowhere near the home. But guess what? We understand the law and the viewers are very adept too. We know what happens next. The prosecution will simply bring in their expert on cell phone data analytics and will refute it. So we're going to have two opposing views here on the same issue. Very much like the radiologist, the patient goes for the MRI to be evaluated. One doctor will say, I'm so sorry, you need surgery. And the other will say, you know what, let's give it a few weeks, you should be okay.
You know, Dr. Debbie, it's so true because, you know, defense teams can hire their defense expert to go against the prosecution's expert. And usually the prosecution's expert, usually, not all the time, is more adept at what he's being claiming to be an expert at than the defense. I remember there was a famous ballistics expert in New York City years and years ago, and he worked on the Son of Sam case. And he used to get on the stand, and the district attorney would verify his credentials and say his last name was Simmons. And they would say, Detective Simmons, how long have you been on the New York City Police Department? He'd be like, 35 years. He had this real raspy voice. How many ballistics cases have you done in that time? I don't know, 10,000, 15,000. And then they would bring in the defense, and the defense expert would say, I've done about 300. Like, so who are you going to believe is more expert, the guy who's done 10,000 cases or the guy who's done 300? Who's the real expert? Who's going to say this bullet absolutely came from this gun? Okay, thank you, Detective Simmons. The defense would say, there's no way it came from this gun, you know, and he's done 300 cases. I think you got to go with the person that's more expert. But the problem with that also comes with doctors, MDs, you know, surgeons, pathologists. Sometimes they can get someone to go against the pathologist. Lots of times. Professor Mike.
Yeah, Billy, that's one of the problems with what I'm looking at. When you call a defense witness here, now, say, for instance, the defense witness had worked maybe for the FBI or for, say, Verizon or something like that, and they've been retired a few years. And now they, you know, rent themselves out as experts. And they know a great deal about the state of, you know, telephone, cell phone technology, tower technology, things like that. But things in that technology in that field advanced so quickly. If you retired 5 or 10 years ago, that was in its infancy. And so what you can bring to the table as an expert may not be actually, it may be stale. The information may be stale. It may be old. It may be out of date. And it may not be nearly as powerful as the prosecution's witnesses who are actually still doing it every single day and who are up on the technology. You know, you have these people in the FBI. This is their field of study. And they're doing it, and they're doing it now. They haven't retired 5 years ago. They're doing it absolutely right now. So they're bringing technology 2024 to the trial rather than technology from 2014, like maybe an expert would bring. So it may be a battle between, you know, two equally sounding, convincing witnesses who may both be sincere, and they may somewhat cancel each other out. And if that happens, you still have other evidence, the cameras, the DNA, things like that. And you point out, Dr. Debbie, the picture on his phone, things like that, which, you know, may weigh heavily against him. So if I'm the prosecutor, I'm not really worried about this so-called alibi witness whatsoever.
You know, I want to play, first, before I play this video, which is going to be a visible, a visual timeline, I just want to say something. Cell phone technology and the tracking of such has been unbelievable in the past few years. When we saw what they did in Oklahoma, which was the most rural of rural areas, and they were able to find where the body was buried by tracking those booster phones, right? And they tracked it right to within, as you said before, like 20 feet of where the bodies were buried.
Right.
And it's like, it's incredible. And then the other technology, I'm not going to get deeply into it, geofencing, which can pull up all electronic devices being used in a specific geographic area at a specific time. Unbelievable technology. I want to play a little bit of this detailed visual timeline, and then we'll talk about it afterwards.
At this point, they get picked up by a car service, and about 6 minutes later, they arrive at home on King Road. According to an affidavit, Ethan and Zana are already in the house, along with two other roommates. 2:47 a.m., according to police, a phone belonging to the suspect, Brian Koberger, stops connecting to the cell network in nearby Pullman, Washington. This is where he lives and studies criminology as a PhD student at Washington State University. 2:53 a.m. Authorities say a white sedan consistent with a vehicle registered to Koberger is seen traveling towards the highway that connects Pullman and Moscow. It's only about a 10-mile drive between the two cities. At 3:29 a.m., surveillance footage obtained by police from the King Road neighborhood captures a white sedan making an initial drive by the victim's house. Authorities say this car will make another two passes in the next 30 minutes. It's 4 a.m. According to the affidavit, Zana receives a DoorDash delivery. And a source tells ABC News that the delivery is contactless and the order is left at the front door. A surviving roommate would later tell authorities that around this time, 4 a.m., she wakes up to what sounds like Haley playing with her dog in the room on the third floor. She also reports hearing someone say, "There's someone here." 4:04 a.m., authorities say the white sedan is seen driving into the neighborhood a fourth time. 4:12 a.m., according to phone records obtained by police, Zana is awake and using TikTok. The affidavit states that the same surviving roommate says she hears what sounds like crying coming from Zana's room. She opens her door a second time and says she hears a male voice say something to the effect of, "It's okay, I'm going to help you." At 4:17 a.m., this security camera on a neighbor's home picks up distorted audio of what sounds like voices or a whimper followed by a loud thud. A dog can also be heard barking numerous times. This camera is less than 50 feet from Zana's bedroom. The affidavit states their surviving roommate then opens her door a third time. She sees a masked man walking past her towards the sliding glass door in the kitchen. In frozen shock, she locks her door. 4:20 a.m., police say the white sedan is seen leaving the neighborhood at a high rate speed. 5:25 a.m., authorities say that same vehicle is seen on five cameras back in the Pullman area near where the suspect lives. And then, between 9:12 and 9:21 a.m., police say data collected shows the suspect's phone appearing near the scene of the murders. About 8 hours after the killings, a 911 call reports an unconscious person at the scene of the crime. Shortly after, Moscow police discover the body.
All right, I'm going to take this off the screen right now. And Dr. Debbie, look at all those timestamps. Unbelievable, right? So now with all those timestamps we have, now his attorney is going to have to get a ruler and a map and see all the timestamps that are built in here that she now has to say, oh, this is when he was gazing at the cumulus clouds, and this is when he was looking at, I mean, it's ridiculous. It really is.
It is, Sergeant.
I'm going to give you the stage.
No, I'm just agreeing. It's absolutely ridiculous, and it's nonsense. And this whole time frame is very solid and substantive for the prosecution. And let us not forget one thing, just based on logical reasoning, knowing who Brian Koberger is, and maybe he wants us to believe who he is not, you know, the stargazer and moon admirer, but he's a manipulative, narcissistic, grandiose individual. So when we look at those characteristics, I would not be surprised, and I think it should be discussed, his turning off the phone at convenience, turning it back on at convenience. And I'm very certain that that's part of what happened here. But even as we look at the miles and the distance in between, we're talking potentially tops 10-mile radius between where he is and where the home on King Road is. So if the phone is turned off, then the data has been manipulated. That's all a jury needs to hear, I think.
Dr. Debbie, that means, and I'll mention Bobby Chacone, who's been on this show frequently, is a retired FBI agent, attorney, really smart guy. He said to us when he was on our show last, he says, one of the biggest pieces of evidence is that the phone was turned off. Not necessarily the tracking of it, but that it was because only someone that was, Mike, I'm going to let you use your famous term.
It's a consciousness of guilt.
Yes, yes.
I like that.
Exactly that. Yeah. He's trying to cover his ass, and he doesn't want to get caught. So this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to shut. But and one of the things, Mike, and I want to mention this, and Dr. W, you'll see my investigative brilliance too with this. The police should also check his phone going back to see, has he ever before this turned his phone off? Because if he hasn't, then this was a special night, wasn't it?
Yes.
Billy, remember, in this affidavit with the alibi, he said he frequently took drives at all hours of the night to clear his mind and things like that. If they go back, like you just said, if they go back and they don't see that phone moving from his apartment for like say 6 or 8 hours during those times, and not and also not moving around the county of Washington and going to different parks, they can question him on that. If he gets on the stand and say, you said you frequently took these nighttime drives, but we don't see anywhere with cell phone technology that your phone was ever driving around with supposedly you in the car, more than once or twice, maybe in the evening between July 1st and November 30th. You said you frequently did this. Also, do you have pictures maybe when you're stargazing with geolocation for the camera? Did you take any pictures? Did anybody see you? Can anybody vouch for the fact that you actually do this sort of thing? I mean, I got to ask you, Dr. Debbie, does he come across as a loner, or does he come across as a social butterfly to you that would actually be around people a lot and want to be part of a crowd and actually want to be invited to parties and do things? Is he like a social person, or is he really like a loner?
Yeah, that's a great question, Sergeant and Professor Mike. So when we first started talking about this in November, I was asked by a TV network to, because we didn't know who he was yet, maybe 5 days after this atrocity took place, I was asked to give a profile of who I thought this could potentially be. And I did say that I felt it could very well be a student within the 20s, a male, and that we would find information on social media, that some type of connectivity, not necessarily a friend, but an associate, and that could be revealing to us. So 6 weeks later, we know the law enforcement experts did an amazing job in identifying him. So now fast forward a few months, and as we've been following it very closely, every update, I did come up with a theory that I think applies to him directly. And I title it JAR, J-A-R, an acronym for Jealousy, Anger, Revenge. So I really think, Professor Mike and Sergeant Bill, that Brian Koberger was indeed a loner. But the however is, he was a wannabe. He did want to be in some type of friendship circle. He did want some type of intimacy. But I think in terms of JAR, he was jealous of our four victims because they were friendly and outgoing and popular and connected to their peer group. He was not. I think in this social media outreach that we will see upon trial, where he did reach out to them, but they did not communicate back, I think it angered him. And I think he was just angry being alone. He really did not want to be alone. And we don't even know if he had any type of just male friendship, let alone an intimacy with a young lady, but there's really no name that we've heard that's even a friend of his to have lunch with, play basketball with, see a movie with. And then ultimately the R, he sought revenge. He just decided that he would take the ultimate revenge and take their lives. Jealousy, anger, revenge.
Absolutely. Thank you. We had heard, and Dr. Debbie, that's a brilliant piece of academic work right there, your JAR acronym. Jealousy, anger, revenge. I think I love acronyms, and that's the only way I can remember anything.
I do too. Yeah.
Or else I write things in my phone and I just look it up. Oh, that's what I have to get at the supermarket. But the other thing was the term that came about during this case. And I had, in all my years in the NYPD, all my years in homicide, all my years in the detective bureau, I had never heard the term incel. Mm-hmm. And Mike, are you familiar with it?
Yeah.
Okay, then maybe I just missed class that day. You want to explain it to us?
Oh, no. I never heard about it until this case.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm like you. I'd never heard of this term.
And really what it means is involuntarily celibate, which is what Dr. Debbie was just talking about without using that specific term. So someone that is involuntarily celibate can be sexually frustrated and have all of this pent-up anger building up inside of them because you know, they don't want to be celibate. That's why it says incel. They're involuntarily. So all of this pent-up violence is inside them, and what they may be plotting something like it. It seems that he did plot, Mike.
Yeah, Billy. I don't. You know, he can say all he wants about in this alibi, and his expert witness may say, "Oh yeah, look, this cell phone tower pings in this location. It covers 1122 Kings Road, but it also, in some instances, can cover, you know, west 10 miles towards Washington, Pullman, Washington." And if the cell tower is busy closest to where Brian's phone is, well, then maybe it'll bounce off another cell phone tower that has a lesser load or something like that. And he could talk all he wants. And, you know, that's fine. But will he be able to establish to the, you know, jury's satisfaction a pattern of behavior supposedly frequently engaged in of actually driving around? And, you know, because if he had done that many times, did he leave his cell phone at his home? No, I think you're going to take your cell phone with you and you're going to just drive around because you always just have it in your pocket. You want to clear your head? Okay, I want to drive around at night. But if you're, you know, it's snowy, it's cold, it's rainy, you always want that cell phone just in case something happens, an emergency, maybe slide off the road. He actually is kind of painting himself into a corner. He's putting out there that he frequently did this. That expert witness better be able to show to and satisfy the jury that, oh yeah, that was on numerous occasions, not once or twice, but numerous occasions over the course of 6 months before this happened. So, and he's putting himself out on the street in movement around the area. He says it's west, but not east of Pullman, Washington. But still, he actually kind of paints himself into a corner and he doesn't have a lot of room to maneuver.
100%. Another thing I just want to bring up before I go back to this visual timeline is, and the attorneys may be, they may want to say, oh, the DNA was planted, but that is impossible because no one knew who the suspect was for over 6 weeks. It took 6 weeks to arrest them. So who could have planted the DNA of someone they didn't even know existed, you know? Right. So I don't know how they may try that. They may say, oh, it was touch DNA. They brought it in and he'd been at the house before. They could come up with a million things. But when you pile up all these things we call circumstantial evidence, and I say it all the time, I feel like I'm a professor that always repeats himself. But when you pile up circumstantial evidence real high, it is so convincing. And of course, that type of evidence is that from which inferences are drawn, right? So it's not that smoking gun thing. And rarely do you get the smoking gun, right? But circumstantial evidence, when there's lots of it, it is so, so powerful. And one other thing I just want to talk about, I love timestamps because timestamps give references. And one of the timestamps are a license plate reader catches his car. I'm like, whoa, that's beautiful. The other is a video camera. Other is him turning off the cell phone as he leaves Pullman, Washington. All these timestamps, they're evidence. They are huge pieces of circumstantial evidence. And so when they try to build up this alibi, oh my God, we got to make sure we know everything that the prosecution has so we can build our alibi around it, which to me says that the alibi is just something they're creating. Dr. Debbie.
Yeah, I think that was so well said, what Professor Mike said.
It took me a lot of words, though, Dr. Debbie.
I know, but I'm good at, like, you know, just summarizing what somebody has said and then maybe adding another little statement or two. But so I'm totally with both of you. I think the significant, most significant aspect here to this entire case is a one-inch item called that knife sheath. And for me, it's just absolute nonsense if and when somebody thinks this was planted. No, this was not planted. What happened here is we had a killer who participated in one of the most brutal crimes of this, you know, century for children to go to college and to be brutally attacked and murdered like this is just beyond. And what happened was this killer made a mistake. You know, I think too many people are giving him too much credit to say, oh, he was a PhD. No, he was not. He was studying for his PhD. Yes, he had knowledge, but if he prepared for the perfect crime, guess what? It was imperfect. He left behind the key piece of evidence with his DNA. And guess what? Both of you know this. We'll just remind the viewers, for this to not be Brian Koberger, here's the numeric, which in my head is absolutely astonishing. That would mean for this not to be him, it's one in one octillion. That's a numeric we don't even use in everyday life. It's a scientific term, and that's a one with 27 zeros. There's 1.9 million people in Idaho, and only Brian Koberger's DNA is right there at the crime scene. He made a mistake. We got him on this. All the other circumstantials, beautiful. It'll just, again, solidify. But for me, that is the key point.
100%.
Yeah.
And BB2 from the chat. The Wawai Park was closed during the time he claims was he was there. You have to enter before they close the gates and spend the night, but you can't leave until the morning when they open the gates back up. I'm sure that'll be something that law enforcement will look into in case they try to use that as an alibi. One of the other things that to me, and I'm going to go back to the visual time sequence in a second, the fact that he came back the next morning, to me, is that's what serial killers do. Serial killers go back to admire their work, to see what's going on, so they can live that excitement of, I did that. To see all the police vehicles, and to his surprise, they hadn't discovered it yet. Isn't that amazing? He's back there at like 9 o'clock in the morning, 9:30 in the morning, and nothing's really going on because they hadn't discovered it. Mike.
Yeah, Billy, we know that serial killers, arsonists, people like that, they want to admire their work. They get off on seeing all the emergency vehicles. They get, you know, the firefighters, the ladders, the flames, the news cameras, the people crying, they want to see that. That fulfills them, and they feel like, okay, they had a successful criminal act. So the fact that he would go back, and remember, this is a Sunday morning. They were killed a little bit after 4, between, say, 4:10, 4:20, that sort of thing. He's back there. Just a few hours later, who did he know? Why would he go back there? So the more he relies with an expert on placing him at different places over the course, if he can prove it, over the course of 4 or 5 months, he'll still have to answer for why he would be there. What reason would he be there a few hours? Wow, what a coincidence. You drive by a home where there are 4 bodies brutally murdered in there. What were you doing there? There's no Dunkin' Donuts over there. It's not a Sunday morning. We're getting the newspaper and a bagel. Come on. You know, so he, I think, and for with this sort of alibi, I think he is going to have to get up on the stand himself. I don't, no matter what happens, no matter how good his alibi witness may be, it's not a regular everyday person said, oh yeah, I saw him. He was with me. We were hanging out fishing or drinking beer. No, I think he has to get up on the stand, and I don't think he's going to do very well.
You know, Mike, ordinarily I would say, as we saw Alec Murdoch, it's suicidal to get up on the stand, but there is so much evidence, in my opinion, against Brian Koberger, and it's a death penalty case, that this may be a Hail Mary pass by the defense for him to testify, because what else do they have? This alibi that we're discussing right now is sort of, it's ringing a little pale. I can tell the people in the chat aren't buying it. Although there are people out there and in our audience that believe Brian Koberger is innocent. There's people out there. So I don't happen to be one of them. And I don't think either one of my guests are either, but there are people out there. And some of the things they point to is that there was no blood in his car. There was no, they didn't find the murder weapon. They didn't find his clothing he was wearing when he did this dirty deed. Notice it took him an hour or so, or maybe more, to get back to Pullman, Washington. He had plenty of time to dump his clothing, to dump the murder weapon, to even bury it. He had plenty of time to do that. So they probably never will find the murder weapon or find the clothing he was wearing during this dirty deed. Folks, this is Police Off the Cuff, Real Crime Stories. If you like real crime, true crime from a police perspective, then you're in the right place. And if you're not subscribed to us, go on our YouTube, hit that subscribe button, give us a thumbs up, ring that bell, press that like button, share us with your friends and your family. And also, if you want to contribute to us, we have a Patreon with three different levels, and we have a YouTube channel membership with, count them, five different levels. And our YouTube family and our Patreon family is growing, and we appreciate all you guys that contribute to this show. Well, just even watching it and subscribing is contributing, but we really appreciate all you guys. I want to get back right now to the visual timeline, and we'll comment on this afterwards.
Four students.
The facts of the case that we know right now.
November 16th, police reveal the four victims were stabbed to death.
The four were stabbed with a knife, but no weapon has been located at this time.
We are eternally grateful that we spent so much time with him.
This is Ethan's mom on November 30th at a vigil honoring her son and the three other victims.
That's the most important message that we have for you and your families, is to make sure that you spend as much time as possible with those people, because time is precious and it's something you can't get back.
We're looking for a 2011 to a 2013 Hyundai Elantra.
December 7th, no suspects have been publicly identified, and Moscow police appeal to the public for help.
Any assistance you can give us, anybody that owns one, anybody that knows of someone who owns one or may have been driving one, if you could get a hold of us through our tip line or call us directly, we'd appreciate that.
December 15th, Koberger and his father are driving eastbound on I-70 when they get pulled over by a Hancock County Sheriff's deputy.
Hello.
How you doing?
How y'all doing today? Good, good. Take a look at your driver's license real quick, if I could. See, he's right up on that van, man. He was right up on the back end of that van. So you're coming from Washington State University?
Yeah.
And you're going where? Oh.
We're going to be going to Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
Yep. We're slightly clutching because we're driving for hours.
Hours, days.
They're driving across the country to their family home in Pennsylvania.
Okay. Well, do me a favor, don't follow too close, okay?
10 minutes later, they are pulled over again, but this time by Indiana State Police. Both departments would later say they had no identifying information on the suspect at the time of these stops or the alleged vehicle involved. The Indiana State Police added in another statement that its agency wasn't directed by the FBI to make the traffic stop. 15 days later, Koberger is arrested in Pennsylvania. The FBI identified the suspect by linking DNA evidence from the crime scene to a public genealogy database. January 3rd. He is extradited back to Idaho, where he is charged with felony burglary and four counts of first-degree murder. In a statement, his extradition lawyer in Pennsylvania said his client was eager to be exonerated. The suspect remains in custody, awaiting his next court appearance in June.
So, very interesting. It brings back some of the memories from this case. And of course, Dr. Debbie, you brought up the DNA, which I forget the number, it's more
octillion.
Have in my bank account. There were 20 octillion or something like that.
Yeah.
But interesting. And then initially the DNA, as we recall, was matched to his father. And there's some other suspicious things going on at that house. As he was dumping their garbage into his neighbor's garbage pails, wearing gloves, separating things in the garbage pail. I guess we all do that at 4 a.m. Is there anyone else that does that every at 4 a.m.? Throws your garbage in your neighbor's? I might get shot if I put my garbage in my neighbor's garbage pail. You know, but so some suspicious stuff there too, and him wearing gloves as he's doing it. Again, Mike, consciousness of guilt. He's trying to cover his ass because he does not want to get caught, Professor Mike.
Yeah, Billy, you know, he can, like, he may be a peculiar person. We all have our little idiosyncrasies in life, but, you know, you just have to put everything together, and it's, you got tremendous circumstantial evidence, you know, cleaning his car like 2 o'clock in the morning, taking his garbage, putting it out, you know, in the dead of night where nobody could see, and he's taking his garbage to his neighbor's property. You know, what does he think he's, you know, that's not something anybody would normally do. If you want to wash your car at 2 o'clock in the morning, go right ahead, clean it out, vacuum it, knock yourself out. But, you know, you're taking garbage and you'd put it in your own garbage can. You wouldn't put it, walk across the road or walk, you know, walk 50 feet to your neighbor's garbage can. Why would you do something like that? You know, that all of these things don't pass the straight face test. And so, look, he could try. He's entitled to be considered innocent until proven guilty. But I think what's going on here, too, is that he's looking to just get one juror to say, you know, it could be possible. And then the other 11 might be like, oh, no. But maybe that's all he can hope for at this point. You know, I think it's delaying the inevitable. But that's what he's going for. The prosecution has to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt on all aspects of the crime to 12 people. He only has to prove a reasonable, just a little bit of reasonable doubt to one person to hang a jury. I don't know if he thinks he's ever going to walk free ever again. I don't know why he would do this with this alibi, but I guess it's better than nothing. And Ann Taylor has to zealously advocate her client. Those are the rules of ethics. She's doing her best, you know, with the cards that she's dealt. She's got to play that hand, you know, and she's, it sounds like a little strange to you and me, some of the things he's done and some of the things that have been said in his alibi, but it's all he's got, you know, it's all he's got.
100%. Denise Yaniv, the cell phone metadata and GPS will show you at the park for the time frame. It will show he's been there many times before and will show he didn't turn off the phone. It was out of cell service. You know, Denise, I am certainly not a cell phone expert, but I think there's a difference between going out of range or out of a cell tower than to actually physically turning off your phone. I think it'll show up differently in an electronic signal to these cell phone experts. And we were baffled and amazed at the cell phone work that was just recently done in Oklahoma. So if they could do that type of work in a place that basically has no cell towers, just think what they can do when there are cell towers around. They found that they were in 20 feet. The burner phones were on the location of the body that they buried in Oklahoma, the two bodies. And they came within 20 feet of, and they saw the ground was disturbed. That is scary that the FBI can do that. And the FBI was on this case too. So the defense better have a damn good cellular expert to go up against the FBI in this. Dr. Debbie.
Yeah, so many great things have been said. I'll comment on some of them. First, going back, Sergeant Bill, when you were talking about the knife and the evidence, and do we need the knife? You know, in my opinion, I don't think we need the knife. I think there are just so many other plentiful, tangible items of evidence, the DNA and the knife sheath, the phone pings preceding the murders, the surveillance of the white Elantra, the pictures of the victims and the communication with the victims. So I'll just call that my top five items here. I think Brian Koberger knows exactly where the knife is, and it would be curious if that could be a question even asked some way, somehow, very discreetly and subtly about the knife just to see reaction. And I'm also wondering, could he potentially be given a lie detector test at any point in time to really see what the deviation is and, you know, the variables of how he might react and respond to some of these questions? You know, the whole thing about the drive, a lot of this, and to piggyback with Professor Mike, it just feels illogical and unreasonable. It's not within the framework of what would the logical, reasonable person do. And I will say that I believe in the jury system and the jury process. I believe that once we have our men and women identified and collected and, you know, ready to go here with an actual trial, I feel that jury members try their best. They really are instructed to just evaluate the facts and put other extraneous details, you know, on the back burner. So if they evaluate everything in its, you know, first singularity as it'll be presented, and then when they look at the totality, I think they will really, to Professor Mike's point, and it is a good one, could they get one person potentially to say there's doubt here with this cell phone? I don't think so. I think they'll see through it. You know, you're mentioning kind of this playing of the game. I think that's what this is. The defense attorney had to come up with something, this long drive to nowhere. That's what we were originally told months ago. But now there's a little more specificity here with the moon and the stars and the hiking. Well, let's back that up, right? Professor Mike said that. Where are the pictures? How do we know you've even done that in the last 6 months? So it can't just be statements that are frivolous with no evidence and no documentation and no verification. So if we get that, then maybe we're moving into an area that could be a little gray. But again, for me right now, it's just a playing of a game, coming up with something rather than nothing, with nothing to lose.
100%. Wilesy Pony, my dream team panel, the Supreme Commander at Father Gary and at Dr. Debbie. Look at all those hearts. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Appreciate the love. Someone the other day, you know, something, I love reading the chat, and I love the good stuff and I love the bad stuff. One of the names in the Oklahoma case was the Twombleys, and someone said, "Sergeant, you sound like you have a speech defect when you say Twombly." And I thought that was funny, but I don't know. That's just me. I laugh at myself a lot. And then last week, someone in the chat called myself, Professor Mike, and Bobby Chacon, that brilliant FBI agent with a law degree. They said we were three washed up cops. And I found that to be hilarious too. So I made a little thumbnail and I made a show, three washed up cops comment on blah, blah, blah. I have a sense of humor and I thought it was funny. I don't know if that person would ever come out of the closet and admit to saying that. Denise Yanev, there was a confidential informant right away who gave his name. So they knew exactly who and where he was. Now, was the CIA telling the truth? Denise, I'm unaware of a CIA. I had never heard that. I think the evidence they got was a lot of it was digital. Some of it was video. Some of it was the security at Washington State University. They ran white Hyundai Elantras, and they came up with Brian Kohberger's car being a white Hyundai Elantra and Brian Kohberger. And that's where the investigation started to build, and they started working. And, you know, when you have information and you can work backwards, it's like, wow, that really helps. You know, it to not have just a blank screen. You have somewhere to work from. And, you know, there has – with this case, you got to remember, they had the FBI. They had the Idaho State Police. They had the local police. They had all of the state investigators for the district attorney's office. So they had a huge pool of investigators to work on this case. And despite that, the news was calling this a cold case after 6 weeks, which I felt was incredibly bad taste that the news even said that. Mike?
Yeah, Billy. Everyone is interested in this 24-hour, 7-day-week instant gratification news world we live in. We've seen cases that have been investigated for years, and things happen, but things take a long time. And I think it really was a disservice for networks to say, oh, maybe this should go to a cold case squad, or the FBI should step in, or something should happen. Should this be a cold case? And you, Phil, and I, and Dr. W, you know, you've worked on a number of cases as a criminologist. You know, just consulting you and just getting information that you could work with to help. This stuff takes time. And I just think that we are so used to the, 1 hour long episode of CSI or Law and Order where it ends within 45 minutes or 50 minutes of the beginning of the show. And therefore, it's all wrapped up in a nice, neat bow. And, you know, that was a disservice to the people. They were working hard behind the scenes, CNN and all, not just CNN, but all of the networks. They were famished for news and they were, you know, upset that they didn't have anything to report. And so therefore, they're like almost like discrediting the local police. And that was actually unfair because they were doing a bang up job and they had. And thankfully, they did not have any leaks to the news media. And that shows the professionalism of all the agencies involved. So that was a terrible thing to say about the as to imply like the police didn't know what they were doing.
100%. I want to play this with News Nation, who these are four attorneys talking about this case.
He's also a News Nation legal contributor. Christy Maris, trial attorney and legal analyst, and Arthur Idala. He is a trial attorney and radio host. All right, so let's start with this case. Arthur, is this an alibi defense? I mean, it's actually an alibi defense. They have to legally, right, lay it out in the state of Idaho. But is this an alibi?
Well, he's saying that he was elsewhere, that the phone was with him and he was elsewhere. So that's, yes, that is an alibi. Usually we're used to hearing a human being saying, oh, he was at my house, he was eating dinner. Here they're using technology. But, you know, his kid was studying a PhD. He's supposedly a really reasonably intelligent kid. It's a premeditated murder. I don't think he's going to take his phone with him to the homicide.
But if his phone's off, I don't even understand what the claim is, right? I mean, is the claim now going to be that prosecutors were wrong that his phone was off?
I think so. I mean, look, let's be clear. We cover trials all the time. Cell phone evidence, it's not accurate. The cell phone towers, you could do all that. But if the phone is off at the key times when this murder allegedly happened, and prosecutors, I've seen the evidence suggest that we can prove this killing happened after 4 a.m., I don't know where this goes. And I have to tell you, did anyone else find it a little weird that it's so bare bones? They had a lot of time to come forward with this alibi. And it's only a few pages, and they say, oh, well, we're going to give you more evidence. Once the prosecution gives us more, we'll give you more witnesses who can say where Brian Koberger was. It felt
right,
a little bare bones.
Because, Misty, if they have an alibi based on cell phone of where he was except for the two-hour period when the murders occurred, it's not that powerful.
No, I would say that's not an alibi then, right? During the critical time period. To Jesse's point, you were talking about the submission. They say that the prosecutors are holding back exculpatory information. We don't know what that is. It would have to be turned over. But Dan, this is not a surprise. I mean, the alibi, the looking at the sun, the moon, and the stars, that's a little weird. But the fact that they're going to attack those cell phone records, the location data, we always knew this was going to be a battle of the experts type of case.
Right. But challenging the prosecution's expert is different from bringing in your own saying he was totally somewhere different. Right. It's not saying you can't rely on this. It's saying that it's not just wrong. It's so wrong that we can prove he was somewhere else.
It's the prosecutors who are saying in their search warrant affidavit that his phone was off. I don't believe the defense is admitting to
that. Right,
right. So they're going to say, no, his phone wasn't off. Maybe you misread the cell towers. But, look, I had a case, Dan, where, very, very similar. My client is now doing 25 years in jail. But, his phone was elsewhere. It was kind of weird because it was in one location, then it's elsewhere from the crime scene, and then but someone testified that he gave me the phone.
I've seen difference of opinion about where the phone is or where it's tricked. I haven't never seen a difference of opinion if the phone is off or it's not off. I've never seen that before in a trial where you have one expert saying it was off and one expert saying it was on. I think that, at least that data is pretty clear, unless you could say, well, he was in an area with no service, it was in airplane mode.
Right.
Maybe they could try to say
that. Right. We won't really know until we hear more from this expert.
Well, Misty, how do you think they're going to challenge the DNA evidence in this case? I mean, are they going to say that it was unreliable? Are they going to say he was framed? I mean, what do you expect that they're going to say with regard to the DNA?
Well, there'd be a couple different options, right? One could be that maybe there was some sort of contact DNA that it got in there through another means, through contact with somebody else. We know that he was on the campus at some point. Unlikely. I think they're going to challenge it on the forensics. They're going to say it was trace DNA. We were talking about mitochondrial DNA and challenge the actual science behind the match. And that's what I would expect to see.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that they've looked at the paperwork that they've been requesting for quite some time, how the FBI used this, because one of the things is it couldn't be, we found his DNA and then we arrested him. There had to be a tool that was used. And if they could try to make the argument that it was used improperly to ultimately arrest him, that may be a way to get the evidence kept out of trial in the first place. I think that's a long shot, but that might be where
they're going. The problem that they have here, that the defense has, is it's not just a piece of evidence, right? It's the combination of all this stuff, right? They're matching up the car to the cell phone data. They actually have the car later the next day with him walking out of the same car. They have the DNA. They have the stuff that he was saying on the internet. That's the problem for this kind of case.
So if we're going to be real, and this is my client, I'm going to sit down with him nice and calm, and I'm going to say, young man, you want to die or you want to spend the rest of your life in prison?
Thank you for watching.
Yeah.
That was brilliant, right? So here's a defense attorney saying, there's a hell of a lot of evidence in this case. I'm going to sit down with my client. I'm going to say, young man, do you want to die because this is a death penalty case, or do you want to spend the rest of your life in prison because one of those two is going to happen to you? So do you want to roll that dice and take it all the way to trial and risk the death penalty, or do you want to plead guilty right now? Mike.
Yeah, Billy, he put himself into between a rock and a hard place. And so therefore he's got to pay the price. No matter what he says, there's a mountain of evidence. And I think, I just want to point out when Dr. W, you mentioned the statistic, what's the chances of that DNA not being his? And you said it's a quintillion.
Yeah.
Less people in the world than a quintillion. We measure population in our universe as in a low billions, and quintillion or whatever it is, that's astronomical beyond all belief. It's a numerical, it's a theoretical numerical term. Because we can't even figure out a number that high. We can't even figure out what to say or what to call it. I think that defense attorney is right on. Look, you and I'm hoping Ann Taylor is going to say to him, look, you've got two choices here. We can plead guilty and ask for, and you'll elocute, and then we can ask for life behind bars without possibility of parole, and you'll get that. And if you want to be famous, maybe there's going to be some visitation. You're going to be like your hero, BTK, whose biography that you read, you know, while you were a master's student. Or you could be found guilty, get sentenced to death by firing squad, and you're 32 years old now. By the time you won't make it to 52, you'll be dead. And then people just like wipe their hands of you, and you'll just be a memory to people, a bad memory. What do you want? Do you want to face the firing squad, or do you want life behind bars? I think that's how you have to talk to them, and I'm hoping Ann Taylor has done that. You know, we'll see how.
Mike, I wonder if this also could be the ego of attorneys that want this to go to trial. Because if he pleads, their fame and fortune and their time in the spotlight is over.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think that attorney would say, oh, I can't believe this guy's even suggesting that. But I think that's a real possibility that the attorneys could want to take this to trial because it's a death penalty case, and they're going to be on national television from beginning to end of this trial. So I think, as you said, Mike, they probably do want to go to trial, but they could go to Kohberg and say, look, they got a lot of evidence against you. You're rolling the dice with your life. Do you want to, you probably will, if you get convicted, and there's a good chance it could happen, you could get the death penalty. Do you want to risk that? Dr. Debbie.
I think he does, Professor Mike, Sergeant Bill. Why? Because what Professor Mike said, he hit the nail on the head. I think Brian Kohberger wants to be famous. If we look at Brian Kohberger, the first 28 years of his life, before we even knew his name, before we knew the atrocity and brutality of this case, who was he? He was invisible. He was a vanilla kind of person. Nothing about him stood out in any way, personally or professionally. So now that he, I'm sure, spent months thinking he's perfecting the perfect crime and participating in a quadruple murder, and he himself having gone through the baccalaureate program, master's degree, and now, as we say, moving into the pinnacle of our educational arena, he thought he could do this and get away with it. But I also think he may have thought of a parachute approach as well, that if he didn't get away with it, what's in it for him? The whole world will know his name. He moves from invisible vanilla to somebody, you know, with color, with some kind of, you know, something about him now where he never experienced for 28 years. And I think on the fame issue, although I don't like to call these people famous ever, more infamous, but I think he will enjoy when books are written about him, people talking about him, being on the national platform when this goes to trial, documentaries. I think as we are sitting here speaking about this, he enjoys every single time he's in the spotlight.
I think you're right, Dr. Debbie. From the chat, David Ray, who can tell until the cell tower evidence is released on both sides? And the DNA on the sheath seems suspicious to delay your alibi for so long. You know, David, what we're talking about is because the defense has shit. That's why, just to put it in plain terms, they have nothing. So they had to come up with this, and it probably took her all this time. Like, well, how are we going to develop this? What are we going to say? Oh, he likes to go out, and, you know, when it's 2 degrees outside, and look at the stars and drive around, turn his cell phone off in case he goes into a snowbank. You know, like, it just doesn't make any sense. But that's all they have. So, yeah, you know, you've heard the term grasping at straws. And that's how I feel. I mean, there's probably people that would say, oh, that's not right. I think that he's innocent. Karen Stevens, I heard someone say that he wasn't out stargazing. He was out getting high. That's possible. He has a former career as a heroin addict years ago. I don't know what his drug status was at the time of these murders. But he does have that in his past that he was a heroin addict. Kat 747, stargazer Bree has DNA on knife sheath, white car, same description, cell phone data, yada, yada, yada. I like that. You know what I find also, which we haven't mentioned here, 12 recon trips to 1122 King Road. What does that mean? He reconnaissance doing a dry run to this address 12 times, 12 times. How do you explain that, Professor Mike?
The only thing we talked about this with 6 or 8 months ago, we just kind of talked about a little bit. And I think we came up with the only thing he can possibly say is he was visiting friends in the area to buy marijuana and that his phone pinged off the same cell tower that would service anybody in the neighborhood of 1122 King Road. I think that's about the best he could do. He can't admit he was just driving around the area by himself because he's just mentioning in his alibi that he was out 20 miles away. He liked to drive 20 miles away. But if he sits there and is confronted with the idea that, well, okay, you like to take late night drives 20 miles west into parks and stargaze, but there's 12 times here that you were in this neighborhood. What were you doing? Oh, I was buying marijuana. From who? From whom? What address? You know, provide us with a name. You know, that would have been the time to say, oh, yeah, I do have a drug dealer. I just buy marijuana. It's not a serious thing. It's recreational use. And the guy lives 2 blocks away. You know, it doesn't fly. It just doesn't fly. Not at all.
Not at all. The love of God. BK was under pressure at work, messing up, led to anger. Still don't know evidence on bodies or neighbors' videos. The love of God. He was kicked out of school prior to this. So he was not, his life was falling apart. Let's put it that way. His life was totally falling apart. So that would go with Dr. Debbie's whole thing of like, he's a nobody that wants to be somebody now.
Hey, Bill, can I ask a question?
Go ahead.
Real quick. Yeah, in the timeline, he actually had issues within 2 weeks of teaching, starting his teaching, being a teacher assistant in his first semester with some of the ladies in his class. And he was told twice by his, I guess his supervisor, professor, like, you know, you got to change what you're doing. He actually had his scholarship taken away from him before they found out that he actually had killed these four innocent people. But I just got to ask Debbie, Dr. Debbie, do you think possibly that his anger towards the world, it seems to be mostly ladies, but could he be as angry at the men in his life, like the professor who's got, like, say, who's 50 years old and is trying to get him through a program? Do you think that the anger would go both ways, both to men and women, women who don't want to date him, but men also who may not want to admire him, who may not want to be buddy-buddy with him, to drink beer with him? Does that go kind of both ways?
Absolutely. I think that's wonderfully stated, Professor Mike. And I would say yes and yes. He's angry at the women who, again, ignored him, thought he was invisible, did not want to necessarily interact with him in a friendship manner in the classroom as colleagues and or, you know, in the career path. And men, I think the jealousy may have applied there too, that he would have been jealous of men who did achieve success personally and professionally, who had a nice young lady girlfriend, who were married, who enjoyed the success of a college professor career or something he himself may have one day aspired to be, a police officer. You know, we don't know exactly what did he want to do in life, right? But yes, I think both ways would apply. Angry at the men who achieved success that he had not, and angry at the women who would not want to be with him.
Cool. Thank you.
Absolutely. Gina G, as a devout night owl, I go out for rides in the middle of the night by myself. However, I mix it up. I never take the same route. That would be so boring. I hope you don't turn off your cell phone, Gina G. At BB2, he was stalking them. Marlene, I think law enforcement should look deeper into the gun guys that live near to. I don't want to get into that. That's off topic. Sherlock HS1, 12 times at 1122 house. Yes, that's proven. Vicinity of, very, very close, 12 times. I don't know if that means in the driveway, in the back, you know, so close. But they have that documented, that 12 times he's reconned that house. H. Cook, honestly, the delays are a distraction, an insult to the justice system that's going on with the trial. I think it's still going to take a while. It's in the advantage of the defense because really they don't know what the hell to do right now, to put it plainly. And they're the ones, I think, putting this off. Margaret DeYounger, Ann Taylor used Alfred pleas in previous DP case in December 2023, avoids death penalty. Look, the death penalty is never a sure thing. But when they go for the death penalty, there has to be a death penalty jury. So when they do the voir dire, I hope I said that correctly, Mike, because with my speech defect, you know, I want to make sure I said that right. But they have to query jurors. Are you okay? Could you find someone guilty if it meant giving them the death penalty? And if someone in the voir dire says no, then they're not going to be picked. So this will be what's known as a death penalty jury. Cat 747, yeah, that's just another linchpin, the 12 recon missions. Yes, then those are verified. Those are definitely verified. Tracy Kocher, Ann Taylor said that she believes he's innocent. So I did she have that conversation? Well, every defense attorney is going to advocate for their client. None of them are going to say, oh, my client's guilty as hell, but watch the work I do, you know? No one's going to say that. They're going to say the person. Look, in the Gilgo Beach case, Rex Hume and his attorney, we did a show on that earlier today. He's saying, Rex says he's guilty. He's looking forward to getting out of here and, you know, going about his life once he beats his, come on. We're all like, oh, please, stop it, you know? The 80s kid. Stalking is different from surveillance, and Bill Thompson knows that. Not the average person following the case does, though. Well, look, doing those recons, knowing what we know now, yeah, those were scary. Now that we know that it looks like he's the killer, Yeah. And he did 12 recons of this location almost as a dry run. Gina G, as a devout nine ally, I've done all kinds of things in the middle of the night, including cleaning and taking out the trash, but I've never put trash in my neighbor's trash can. Okay, you're out of, you're not a suspect then in this case. I'm just kidding. Lieutenant Pete Pranzo, good to see you in the chat. Lieutenant Pete, Harlem Raiders, always good to see you. We covered a lot. You know, we covered a lot on this case. We're at an hour and 10 minutes. I think that we all agree an alibi usually is either a person or a place that you can put yourself there that'll make it impossible for you to have done the crime. I don't see him doing that. Professor Mike, your final words.
Yeah, Bill, if he had an actual alibi witness, a regular civilian, not an expert, just a regular person living in the neighborhood where maybe he drank beer with that lived in the neighborhood. That's why he was there on 12 occasions. He bought marijuana from somebody. But, you know, he is the loner. He kept to himself. He had his own little world. He was angry at a lot of people. He struck back at, ladies. We all know that within like 2 weeks of teaching, starting teaching in like September. And he struck back at the supervisor that he had. So he really created a whirlwind of mess for himself, both on that scholastic professional level, the track he was on, and also he had no friends to support him in any way. This is just, as you say, this is the, you know, there's 3 seconds left on the clock. The quarterback's on the 1 yard line. He's throwing the bomb to somebody who's running downfield. He's hoping this person can catch the ball and run it in for a touchdown and win the game. This is like one out of a million plays. That's all he's got. And I just want to point out to the public who's listening in, even if he convinced one juror that there was not that he was not guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, he's not getting out. They're just going to have another trial a year later. So for anybody who's kind of on the fence about this case, don't worry about it. He's not going to be walking around in your neighborhood anytime soon. And we have the FBI. We have tremendous law enforcement capabilities. You don't have to worry about them being inaccurate in any of this technological data or evidence that they have in this case. So people should not worry about this case.
100%. Wilesy Pony, Eileen, we did mention that already, that Brian Koberger returned to the crime scene at about 9 o'clock that morning. And that's the behavior lots of times of serial killers or regular killers that just go back to see what they've done, to sort of relive that, the excitement of it. It's sort of crazy, but we understand that, and we understand that's what they do. So one of the things I used to do when I was in homicide, when we'd have big crowds in front of the crime scene tape, I would take pictures of the crowd, because with the thought that the killer could be in that crowd. And the other thing was, is then when we did canvases and names came up, and I started picking the names that came up in the crowd. And when the guy goes, "I was in New Jersey," I said, "Oh, really? Who's this?" I would show, "Oh, shit," you know. And so it was very helpful. You know, we learned little tricks like that. Even like when we'd have witnesses, we'd canvass in the crowd, say, "Can I get your number?" And I slip on my card, and the person would give me purposely a false number, so I'd call it right on the scene, and I'd be like, "Why are you playing me?" You know. they'd give me their real number because they thought I was born yesterday or something, you know. So those are some of the tricks of the trade you learned. Dr. Debbie, your final words.
Thank you. The overwhelming evidence on this case, I think, is going to show and demonstrate that Brian Koberger is the correct suspect. The DNA and the knife sheath, the car on the surveillance and the video footage, the 12 pings of the phone in the King Road area, the social media communication and pictures on the cell phone, that alone creates a lot of substantive, tangible evidence. I'm not concerned, nor am I worried about this new development with the alibi. And they had to come up with something. So the long drive and the moon and the stars, that's fine. Let it be introduced. Let it be, you know, thought about. And their expert will discredit it, of course, and we'll expect that. But we'll also expect the prosecution to come in with their expert who will have a different view of the data analytics of the cell phone. I believe in the jury process. I think once the jury is identified and selected, they will do a good job. They'll do the right thing, and I believe we'll have the right outcome. And thank you both for having me.
Well, Dr. Debbie, thank you for all your wisdom. Josh DePosh, thank you for becoming a YouTube member. Josh DePosh, 63 gets all New York City cops excited because that's the code for meal. 63. So we'll get excited when we hear or see 63, right, Mike?
1063.
That's meal time, you know. I just wanted to quickly do the Joe Murray commercial. Folks, if you're looking for a great attorney in the New York metropolitan area, then Joe Murray is your man. Joe's a retired NYPD police officer and a fantastic defense attorney. And you can reach Joe on his cell at 718-514-3855. Email him at Joe at jmurray-law.com or go on his website, jmurray-law.com. Not only is Joe a fantastic defense attorney, but also a huge supporter of the Police Off the Cuff podcast. And there's a picture of Joe up on the screen. So folks, we'll continue to cover this case, but I think it's interesting to look at it. And when you see what the defense is trying to put forth as a defense, and we wanted to cover this, and I think the three or the four attorneys on News Nation, you know, with Dan Abrams, I think they were pretty, they all agreed, you know, and it's like, I'm sure you can get four attorneys that don't agree, but a lot of people do agree that this is a pretty damn solid case against Brian Koberger. Thank everyone for tuning in. Have a great night, everyone, and God bless.
Good night.
Good night.
One episode, just ain't enough.